Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello again, and today I'm speaking with anthropologist Hugh Gustafson. After a postdoctoral fellowship at the School of American Research in Santa Fe, Professor Gustafson came to work at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1992. His research focuses on the political culture of nuclear weapons scientists and anti-nuclear activists in the US and the former Soviet Union. He's the author of People of the Bomb, Portraits of America's Nuclear Complex, Nuclear Rights, a Weapons Laboratory at the End of the Cold War, and is co-editor of the book Cultures of Insecurity, States, Communities, and the Production of Danger. UC Press is about to publish his volume co-edited with Catherine Besterman of Colby College, titled Why America's Top Pundits Are Wrong. He's also finishing a book on the US nuclear weapons laboratories after the Cold War. Hugh Gustafson teaches classes on war and peace, ethics and science, drug politics and culture, and the social study of science. Hugh Gustafson joins me now from Watertown, Massachusetts. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Hugh.
Thank you very much, Helen. It's great to be on.
Yeah, well, I've been looking forward to this because I find that the social sciences and anthropological work is really the etiology of the mess that the human race is in. And not a lot of people study it from your perspective, do they?
No, they don't.
I was first introduced to you when I read your book, Nuclear Rights, a Weapons Laboratory at the End of the Cold War. Or it was People of the Bomb, I'm not sure. But what I was so fascinated by was you lived, ate and drank with the scientists at Los Alamos for up to a year. You got to know them sort of intimately and their culture. Mm-hmm. And then you described how they see their bomb making. Would you like to describe that to people? Because I don't think people have any idea of how these characters think or feel, really.
Well, first of all, let me say a little bit about being an anthropologist, because what anthropologists do is we practice a sort of deep hanging out. So, you know, some of the ostensibly harder social sciences, people use surveys and questionnaires and things like that. Mm. Whereas we tend to like to just sort of move in with the people we're studying, meld unobtrusively into the background with a notebook, and just sort of fit into the ebb and flow of daily life and get to really understand what it's like to be in a particular kind of milieu. That's what I did with nuclear weapons scientists. I actually lived with them for 2 years. I lived in three different houses in the town where the nuclear weapons lab was with different people who worked at the lab. I went to church every Sunday, different churches with weapons scientists. I joined the lab singles group. Huh. I joined its basketball team and its baseball team.
Wow.
And just tried to meet as many people who worked at the lab as I could around town. Mm. So I think there's something to be said for this anthropological method. You really get to know people in a very different way if you take the time to just become a part of the fabric of their life.
Mm.
So I just want to put in a little plug for the anthropological method, I guess. And you wanted to know what the weapons scientists are like?
I was just going to compare what you did with Margaret Mead, of course. Did she initiate this way of operating for anthropologists, moved into the islands and lived with the people, or had it been...
Well, she was one of the most celebrated practitioners of, of the method and had a knack for communicating to ordinary people.
Yeah.
It was actually, interestingly enough, a British anthropologist, Malinowski, who invented the technique during World War One. He was a Pole living in Britain.
Yeah.
And during World War One, he was told that as an enemy alien, it would be better if he didn't spend any time in Britain. So he had a sort of enforced, lengthy sojourn on the Trobriand Islands, quite near Australia. It was sort of forced on him by the fact that he was an enemy alien in time of war. And so he accidentally developed this technique of spending a long time with people that you're trying to understand.
And did you find it difficult as what we would say, call a POM in Australia, but an Englishman joining the American, cultural sort of philosophy, if you will, in the labs in Los Alamos? Or were you accepted?
I was accepted, and I was a little startled by this. You know, I thought that as a foreign citizen trying to understand the culture of a top-secret military facility in the U.S., I thought that I would have a very hard time, and it turned out not to be true. But as you might know from having spent time in the U.S., the British tend to be treated with maybe too much reverence in the United States.
Mm.
So I think if I'd been from any other country, I might have had much more difficulty. Mm. I was always convinced as a student that I got a better grade than I deserved because of my accent.
Mm.
The Americans tend to have this thing about the British. There's also, by the way, there are two nuclear weapons labs in the U.S. One is Los Alamos, which developed the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the other is Lawrence Livermore, which was established 7 years after the end of World War II in 1952. And I've done extensive field work of both labs, both Lawrence Livermore and at Los Alamos.
Well, why don't you describe your initiating work with at Los Alamos and you know, what you've discovered those 2 years, Hugh?
Well, actually, the first lab I went to was Lawrence Livermore in California. It's near San Francisco. I moved there at the end of the Reagan years. And I expected to find that people who worked on nuclear weapons were all Reagan Republicans, they were all conservatives who thought that the Soviets were terrible, that there was a real threat of communist domination and so on. And I was surprised to find that many of the weapons scientists I got to know were Democrats, not Republicans. Some of them had protested the Vietnam War when they were younger. They'd been active in the civil rights movement and so on. So there was an interesting mixture, actually, of conservatives and liberals.
Mm.
And I vividly remember one weapons scientist telling me that he could never work on conventional weapons because it would be immoral. And he felt much more comfortable working on nuclear weapons because he was convinced that nuclear weapons would never be used, whereas if you worked on conventional weapons, they were designed to kill people. I mean, you can accept the logic or not, but I was very struck that that was his logic, that he felt morally cleaner working on a weapon that could destroy a whole city than he would have felt working on napalm or a conventional dump bomb or something like that.
Yeah.
The other thing I found was that about three-quarters of the people I interviewed and got to know were some form of active Christian. But most of them belonged to sort of fairly moderate mainline Christian denominations. They were either Catholics or Methodists or Episcopalians or Presbyterians or Lutherans. So relatively few belonged to the sort of born-again Baptist sects. I did meet a few weapons designers who were what you would call evangelical, and I found them the most troubling to get to know, actually, because some of them believed that their work designing nuclear weapons was part of God's plan that you see described in Revelations to swallow the earth up in fire and bring about the day of judgment. But most of the weapons scientists I got to know were mainline Christians who didn't seem to experience much conflict between their Christianity and their work designing weapons of mass destruction, and who were quite sure the weapons would never be used.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's great faith, isn't it?
Well, a lot of critics of the arms race have focused on this strong belief that weapons professionals have that nuclear weapons will never be used. And Robert J. Lifton, the great anti-nuclear psychiatrist, has talked about it as a form of denial and so on.
Well, let's go deeper into what you discovered about these actual bomb designers and how they prepared themselves for their nuclear weapons test in the desert, and their before the test and after the test sort of psychological responses.
Yeah, we're talking about a situation that doesn't exist anymore, by the way, Helen.
At the moment, yeah.
Right. Since 1992, the United States hasn't conducted any nuclear tests at all.
Mm.
This is something that causes some pain to the nuclear weapons scientists who are practicing a form of science that's structured around a forbidden experiment.
Mm.
So they can no longer test anything that they think about, and they feel some bitterness about that. But back in the old days, up until 1992, Basically, the life at the lab was structured around the design of new weapons and the testing of new weapons. So if you asked what it was that the labs produced, they produced nuclear tests. They didn't actually mass produce the weapons. Once the tests had gone okay and they decided that a weapons design was proven, then they handed it over to the manufacturing complex and they had nothing more to do with it, really. A little surveillance of the manufacturing process, and that was that. So what they really lived for was to tweak the designs of old weapons to try and figure out ways of making the weapons smaller and lighter, squeezing more explosive yield out of less plutonium, making them slightly different shapes, things like that. Weapons designers would compete with one another, proposing fiendish new design ideas that would be vetted by review committees within the lab and within the Pentagon and so on. And if a designer was lucky enough to have one of the few ideas that made it onto the shot schedule, then they would work quite feverishly often for months and months as the test neared completion. And particularly in the last few weeks, just before a test, these designers could be working 60, 70, even 80-hour weeks. I would hear stories of people sleeping in cots in their offices at the lab because the intensity of the work had become so great and so on. And then it culminates with a trip down to the Nevada nuclear test site, which is where the United States tested all of its nuclear weapons after the 1950s. They would dig an enormous, great big hole. The device, as they called it, never called a bomb, always called a device. The device would be loaded onto this great big canister with lots of very complicated, expensive diagnostic equipment. And that diagnostic equipment, by the way, would be completely destroyed in the nuclear test. Its job is to measure the output of the nuclear device in a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second before it's vaporized by what it's measuring. These tests by the late 1980s were costing as much as $40 or $50 million apiece.
Oh my God!
Was doing about 18 of them a year. Each lab was doing 8 or 9 of them a year. So the culmination of this process comes with the trip down to the Nevada test site. They would watch the device being emplaced in this great big hole with all this diagnostic equipment attached to the canister, and then the hole gets backfilled because it would have been a violation of international treaties for radiation to escape when the test happened. So then they would retreat to the control room, and from there they would watch the moment of the test actually is the flickering of some needles on oscilloscopes. That would be all they would see. It wasn't like the old days when nuclear weapons were tested above ground and you would have to put on these very, very thick glasses to protect your eyes from the flash, and you would feel the heat, you would feel the shockwave and all of that. It was really much more of a sterile kind of experience by the 1980s when nuclear testing had been forced underground. And then the final stage of the process, within a few hours of the explosion, usually an enormous crater would appear in the desert. You know, the bomb would have vaporized enough of the earth that eventually a crater would collapse. And some of the designers to this day like to go down to the Nevada test site and look at their craters. I mean, they're the authors of these craters, these massive movements of earth.
Which are radioactive, of course.
Well, the idea is that the radioactivity is contained underground. I don't know how 100% successful that was.
No.
I've done a tour of the Nevada test site.
Yes.
And, you know, officials can have more confidence than they should have in the cleanliness of what they've been doing, I guess. But there are some parts of the test site that they wouldn't take me into because they were still radioactive, and that was where they'd done a lot of above-ground tests in the older days. They claim that the craters pretty well seal everything in.
Oh, well, and some of them vent too, so, you know.
Some of them vent, and there was a famous test, Bainbury, I think it was called.
Yeah.
In 1972 or 73, which leaked this massive radioactive plume that went all the way to Canada, which put the U.S. in violation of its treaty obligations.
All right, well now, so that's the mechanics of the thing, but tell us about their psychological state as they built up to the test of their very precious, quotes, device.
It's like the process of any kind of creative process that's very intense. You know, it's like someone working on a book manuscript or working on a dissertation, or a musician working on an album that they're recording, I guess. They become more and more absorbed in the task. Unlike writing a book, this is a much more collective process where people have to interact with people in massive teams of chemists and engineers and technicians and so on. So people become quite tightly bonded to these other people that they work with, I think. And then when it's all over, people would talk about feeling this sort of experience of psychological letdown afterwards because they'd been working so feverishly and working such long hours on this thing, and then suddenly it was over, and what do you do? Many people who write books report the same thing. They sort of dread finishing their book manuscript because then they have nothing to do for a while, and there's this sort of vacuum that appears in their lives afterwards. What your listeners might also be interested in, though, is what this is like for their families. I mean, for the scientists themselves, they're having this incredibly intense experience bonding with other people in their team at work. But there's a sense in which, for their families, this is experienced as a real loss. The scientists are often traveling, so they're not at home. Even if they're not traveling outside the lab, they're working long hours in the lab and may not be home very much. They can't bring the work home with them to do at home because it's secret, so they have to do the work at the lab. So wives of weapons scientists would talk about being science widows. Their husbands weren't dead, their husbands were alive, but they felt as if they were sort of bereaved of their husband's presence because the husbands were working such long hours and became sort of psychologically focused on something going on elsewhere that they weren't allowed to talk about very much with their families. So their kids and their wives would talk a lot about this sort of sense of having lost a family member in the process leading up to a test. Now, I should also say I'm talking about scientists' wives as if all of these people are men. And the majority of them are men, but by no means all of them. In the 1980s in the United States, only about 5% of physics PhDs went to women. The other 95% went to men. So physics was a very male-dominated discipline. And actually, at the weapons labs, there was a slight overrepresentation of women among the weapons designers, more like 6 or 7% of them would be women. And one woman weapons designer at Los Alamos once told me that she thought that the female mind was particularly well suited to nuclear weapons design because when you change one variable, everything else changes with it. She argued that women think more holistically, and so she thought that they had a better aptitude for nuclear weapons design.
She was right in that respect, but to apply it to annihilation. Anyway, I'm interviewing Professor Hugh Gustafson, who's an eminent anthropologist. Hugh, I remember vividly when I wrote my book, The New Nuclear Danger, describing some of the terminology that the scientists used that you recount in your book. And one was they talked about giving birth to the bomb and the need to push. And then after the explosion, they talked about postnatal depression.
Correct? Correct. And actually, they also talk about missiles being connected to the outside world by umbilical cords. The very first bomb that was tested was referred to as Oppenheimer's baby. The one dropped on Hiroshima was little boy. So there is all this sort of language of metaphors of birth. That surround this whole enterprise. When you get radioactive decay processes, they talk about the results being daughter products and so on. So there is this language of fertility and birth and so on. And different academics have interpreted that a little differently. There's a man called Brian Easley, who's a sort of psychoanalytically inclined academic, and he's argued that what this is all really about is men with birth envy, because they can't give birth the way women can. They're trying to do something as awesome as birth, and testing a nuclear weapon is something as awesome as birth. And they're sort of betraying their deeper, unknown, unconscious motives by using all this language of birth. I'm not sure I buy into that. It's a very interesting theory. It's one that you can't really prove or disprove. I've asked many weapon scientists themselves, actually, why do they use all these birth metaphors? And what they say is, well, you know, it's just a creative process. You use birth metaphors to describe any creative process, don't you? In my book, I tried to argue that it's also an attempt on their part to argue that this is really about saving lives and not killing people. And so the language of death is really banished from the world of nuclear weapons scientists. They don't talk about killing people. They talk about collateral damage. They always talk about targets rather than people being killed and so on. People are not incinerated. They're always carbonized. So there's this anesthetizing language from which death is banished. But there's this very rich set of metaphors about birth. And I've always wondered if that wasn't partly an attempt on their part to say, no, no, we're really about life. We're not about killing people, which, of course, you can see as a form of denial, but there you have it.
Well, I said in my book, interpreting from yours, that it's giving birth to annihilation, which amazes me from a masculine perspective. I'm fascinated by the way these men think. I want to write a book called Why Men Kill, and I have to read for 2 years before I've got enough information.
I'm curious to know from you, Helen, what you make of the women who...
Oh, right. Well, you know,
these metaphors
I guess what I'd say is they've probably got a rhinoblastomas on their ovaries, which is a tumor that secretes testosterone. I'm being facetious, of course, but, you know, they've been masculinized. And like Maggie Thatcher and Indira Gandhi, they've joined the male ethic. And, you know, in this world for women in the past and presently now to get on in the world as some very... voraciously adapt the male ethic to achieve what they need to achieve. And it's pretty tough in the male world. Well, I've experienced that anyway at Harvard Medical School and academia. Mm. You know, they sort of psychologically kill each other in the corridors, you know, to get where they want to go. That's not true for everyone, but it is. And I'm sure it happens in the corporate world and in the political world. I know it does. And then one could extrapolate from that into the well, not really, but into the weapons labs. This is an entirely different thing, and yet is a culmination, in a way, of the male ethic and the inability, I don't know, to give birth. I don't know, but I'm fascinated by your interpretation.
Well, I think there's no doubt that the weapons labs are very masculine environments, and to be a woman scientist there is to be in a fairly small minority. Mm. As well as the weapons labs, I spent many years teaching at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is a very similar male-dominated techno-scientific environment. And I think women often get forced into adopting these male roles in places like that.
Well, I knew Randi Forsberg very well, of course, who wrote The Freeze, Nuclear Weapons Freeze, and she and I worked together. In fact, she turned me onto the fact that nuclear war would only take 1 hour to complete bilaterally, because that's how long the missiles take, only half an hour to go from Russia to America and vice versa. And she was a leading thinker in this area, and it took her many, many, many years to be accepted by the male academic people at MIT. Eventually she was, I think. But, you know, it was tough for her, and yeah, it's hard not to get resentful along the way. And then if you get resentful, then, of course, you're ostracized anyway.
I knew Randi, who tragically died of cancer earlier this year.
Yes,
and was a brilliant, wonderful person.
Brilliant.
And I think there were three problems she struggled with in terms of being accepted.
Mm.
One was being a woman in this very masculine world of nuclear weapons intellectuals. The second was, though, that she was a graduate student. I mean, astonishingly, she wrote the Freeze Resolution when she was a graduate student. She won a MacArthur Genius Award when she was a graduate student. And I think professors were really confused by her. She was supposed to defer to them because she was a graduate student. But here she was, you know, she'd started a global movement and she had a MacArthur Genius Award, which they didn't have.
Jealous.
Yeah, and I think they felt conflicted. They avoided her because it was just too confusing to know whether to defer to her or whether to lord it over her. But then the other thing is that the defense intellectuals at MIT tend to be a fairly conservative community, and she was discernibly to the left of them, and that was troubling for them as well.
Yeah, she was on the envelope. She was really moving out. I must say, personally, I experienced some of that too, because I sort of think on my feet when I speak, and I'd kind of develop new theories as I went along, and I'd find that the people at the Kennedy School at Harvard would sort of rubbish me and, you know, problem with the Freeze movement is Helen Caldicott, yak, yak. And then I'd find they'd take these specific ideas that I'd formulated out of the blue and write papers about it and claim them as their own. So, you know, it's all a bit tricky. I'm interviewing Professor Hugh Gustafson, a wonderful, a notable anthropologist. Hugh, you wanted to talk about the RRW, or the Replacement Reliable Warhead. What
right.
are your notions about that?
Well, let me give your listeners a little context on the RRW, the Reliable Replacement Warhead. In 1992, the administration of Bush the Elder, not the current Bush administration, but the other Bush administration, decided to end nuclear testing. And when Bill Clinton came to power, he decided to turn a moratorium on nuclear testing into the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which his administration negotiated. The weapons labs were not very happy about this. It wasn't just that nuclear tests were what they lived to do and they were losing their main product, but they were also concerned that the nuclear stockpile, the U.S. back in those days had about 20,000 nuclear weapons. It has less than 10,000 now, probably about 6,500.
Oh, I thought it was 11, Hugh, if you count all the ones in storage.
Yeah, if you count the ones in storage, yeah. It's more like 10. Like, and they're supposed to go down to around 2,000 weapons by 2012.
But they can still keep some in storage to be used.
They can keep them in storage.
Yeah, so, yeah.
But they were worried that they had this big stockpile and that they could no longer work on improving it or replacing it, that its design features were being frozen in place.
Mm.
And they were worried about how to train a new generation of weapons designers without them being allowed to do any testing. Because traditionally, the way you train new designers is that you apprentice them. They get to look over your shoulders during a nuclear test. They get to work on little bits of it. Then they get trusted with more and more of it until they get their own test. Well, that whole system of apprenticeship can't work anymore because it relied on nuclear testing as what you apprenticed to do. And they were worried that they had these weapons they designed that were very temperamental. They were sort of right on the very edge of working properly, and they were concerned that as they aged, they might not work. So they struck a bargain with the Clinton administration where they agreed that if the Clinton administration gave them more money not to test nuclear weapons than they had given them to test nuclear weapons in the past, then they would find a way of maintaining the stockpile without nuclear testing and of training new designers without nuclear testing. And so they developed this enormous program of simulations, which they call stockpile stewardship.
And maintenance.
It's a way of, it's a way of maintaining the arsenal, but it's also a way of simulating aspects of nuclear tests.
Mm.
So, for example, the Lawrence Livermore Lab is in the process of building the most powerful laser on Earth.
Mm.
It's an astonishing thing. It's a $5 billion laser called the National Ignition Facility.
Mm.
When it's finally finished, it will create temperatures and pressures greater than those inside the sun. And it will do this a few hundred yards from a suburban housing development. When they press the button, it will use the entire U.S. electricity supply for the fraction of an instant when they press the button. So it is an astonishing machine, and it enables the scientists to figure out more about the processes within a nuclear explosion. It gives them a different way of training young scientists and so on. So that's all background to say that since the early to mid-1990s, the weapons labs have been building this very lavishly funded program of simulations that includes lasers and supercomputers and all sorts of very expensive other machines. And they've been recruiting new young designers. Well, in the last two or three years, they've decided that the program was not working as well as they hoped it would. They're worried in particular that you really cannot train a new designer without having them design a new weapon. And they're concerned that these very temperamental high-end nuclear weapons they designed, as the parts wear out, you can't quite replace them with identical parts, and they're worried they're going to lose confidence in them as time goes on. So if you like, what they want to do is replace a stockpile of Porsches with a stockpile of Honda Civics. And that's what the RRW is about. The Reliable Replacement Warhead is a sort of clunky bomb that they are sure will be super reliable. And the point of designing it is, first of all, to replace the nuclear Porsches with the Honda Civics, but also to give the younger designers something to do so that they can learn how you design a weapon. So they had a design competition between the two labs, Livermore and Los Alamos. Livermore won that design competition, and it looked as if they would be given $100 million to go ahead and design a prototype reliable replacement warhead. And then just a couple of months ago, Congress pulled the plug on the funding. So it's been completely cancelled. The weapons labs were begging for $10 million at least just to keep hope alive, just to do little computer studies on it and so on. And Congress didn't even allow them to have that. So at the moment, there's this kind of standoff. The labs have not given up on the ROW by any means. They're still pushing for it. But the current Congress has refused to give them any money for it. And I guess they're going to keep arguing about it next year and maybe the year after. It is notoriously difficult in the United States to kill a weapons program. It's very hard to drive a stake through the heart of a nuclear weapon or any other kind of weapons program. I remember President Jimmy Carter thought he'd canceled the B-1 bomber, but it came back from the dead. The military contractors waited for a more sympathetic president, and then they just brought it back, and now it's flying around dropping bombs on Iraq. So I'm not sure that we've seen the last of the ROW.
Well, isn't there a group of scientists, very eminent scientists, called the Jasons, who inspected at length all the bombs in the U.S. arsenal and said that almost all of them would be reliable for the next 100 years, and there's no need to replace them with the RRW?
Yeah, that's broadly correct. Let me correct a slight misimpression your phrasing might have given your listeners. You made it sound as if they actually sort of opened up the casing of thousands of nuclear weapons and peered around inside to make sure they were okay. What they did was a bit more abstract than that. They reviewed a lot of scientific studies about the way plutonium behaves as it ages. And the weapons designers have been concerned that plutonium is a very temperamental kind of substance that can behave quite unpredictably if you're not careful. And the weapons designers have been concerned that as plutonium ages, the radiation it generates might produce chemical changes within the plutonium that would stop the plutonium from exploding properly. And the Jasons reviewed all of those studies, and they concluded that they expect the plutonium to age gracefully, as they put it, so that they think the plutonium cores of nuclear weapons will be quite reliable for 80 to 100 years. And they think that the arming and detonation and fusing systems of the weapons can be maintained so that they'll be reliable as well. So yes, you're right. The Jasons are this group of eminent professors who do independent review of weapons programs for the Pentagon, and they've concluded that they have high confidence in the stockpile. Now, the weapons scientists have turned around and said, well, but who's the real expert here? We're weapons scientists, so they're just Jasons. So there's a sort of technical dispute between the Jasons and the weapons labs on this. But certainly the study that the Jasons did is one of the reasons why Congress decided not to fund this. Now, the other reason, though, is that at a time when the United States is putting a lot of pressure on North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, putting a lot of pressure on Iran not to go down that route, and generally talking about the importance of non-proliferation for nuclear weapons, it makes the United States look like hypocrites. If they are designing a new nuclear warhead and mass-producing it while they're lecturing the rest of the world on the importance of not making nuclear weapons. And so I actually went down to Congress. I live in Washington, D.C., and I went down to Congress and I watched these debates that they had. And a number of congressmen were very concerned with how it would look to the rest of the world for the U.S. to go ahead and build a new warhead while they were lecturing other people not to do the same thing.
Fascinating. This is Professor Hugh Gustafson, who's an anthropologist of some renown. There were two questions out of that discussion, Hugh, and then we'll move on to the next thing. They must have to replace the fusion trigger, which contains tritium, whose half-life is only 12.3 years. Do they do that routinely in the nuclear weapons?
Yeah, they do. I mean, if you're reducing the size of the stockpile, you can cannibalize the old weapons. You can take tritium out of the tritium reservoirs and use it to top up the tritium reservoirs of the weapons that are still in the stockpile, because the U.S. doesn't really have a tritium manufacturing capability right now. Tritium has a half-life, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's around 12 years.
Yeah, 12.3,
so
yeah.
In 12 years, a half of the tritium you've put inside a nuclear weapon will be gone, and you don't get all the bang that you want out of it unless the tritium reservoir is full. But that's a pretty simple procedure, just to keep topping up the tritium.
Well, the other obvious thing, and Randy Forsberg would say that if the DSL was with us, was it's totally hypocritical and always has been for the US, even if they're not replacing their warheads, to lecture other countries about not developing their own warheads when America still has in stockpile and ready to go about 10,000 hydrogen bombs, which could induce nuclear winter and the end of most life on Earth. So, you know, even if they're not replacing it, it's still terribly hypocritical. Would you not agree?
Oh, I completely agree. Uh-huh. And, you know, as I know you well know, when the United States ratified the Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1970, one of the things they ratified was Article 6 of that treaty. Mm. And Article 6 committed the established nuclear powers to negotiating in good faith to ending the arms race and eliminating all nuclear weapons. And they agreed to a prompt cessation of the nuclear arms race in 1970. Those were the exact words in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I don't think many people would think that waiting until 1992 to end nuclear testing was a prompt cessation of the nuclear arms race.
No.
And increasingly, I think people from countries that don't have nuclear weapons are getting impatient with the U.S. especially, but all the nuclear powers, wondering when they're going to get serious about honoring their obligations under Article 6. I mean, the U.S. is busy proposing sanctions against Iran, which is not proven to be trying to acquire nuclear weapons. It's just enriching uranium.
Mm.
There are innocent and less innocent reasons for enriching uranium.
Yep.
And Iran is allowed, under the terms of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to enrich uranium for nuclear energy plants.
Mm.
But the U.S. is busy proposing sanctions on Iran for supposedly violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty, when I think any detached, objective observer would say that by far the largest violators of the Non-Proliferation Treaty must have been the Russians and the Americans for sitting on these enormous stockpiles in spite of their Article 6 commitments.
Yeah, there's another book for you, Hugh. Anthropological Mechanism, that the US and Russia deploy to justify their huge stockpiles and the, you know, possible annihilation of life on Earth at any moment.
Well, and I found certainly in the late 1980s and early 1990s that most people at the weapons labs were actually unaware of Article 6 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I mean, I remember having conversations with very well-educated warhead designers who knew a lot about nuclear strategy, and one of them just told me flat out I was wrong, saying that the U.S. and the Russians had any commitment under the Non-Proliferation Treaty to end the arms race. I was so angry I went home and Xeroxed the treaty and mailed it to him immediately. I think now those commitments under the treaty have been much better reported by the U.S. press.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question why that is, but I think in the last 5 or 6 years, knowledgeable Americans who read the newspapers with some care have become more aware of how the rest of the world feels about that.
Yeah.
I also find something that, as an anthropologist, I find particularly offensive. When you talk to weapons scientists or to other kinds of nuclear weapons professionals, there's a uniform assumption that Americans, the only people to have ever used nuclear weapons in war, that Americans can be uniquely trusted with nuclear weapons in a way that black and brown people and non-Christians in particular cannot. And so you hear people say openly that you can't trust Muslims with nuclear weapons because they're maniacs, that Muslims don't value their own lives, all they care about is Allah, so they'll be quite happy to blow up their own countries. And you hear it said that only Americans and Europeans really have the restraint that's required of people with nuclear weapons. To be blunt, I think this is racist, and it flies in the face of the evidence that the U.S. is the only country ever to have used the things.
Well, what is this, Hugh? Is this the projection of the dark side by these Americans onto others? What is it?
Yeah, I think it is indeed partly that. I mean, all of us struggle with parts of our unconscious persona that we find it hard to come to terms with, and we project them onto other people, and then we demonize those other people, right? It's been well established by psychologists that this is part of the psychological process that makes it possible to wage war on other people, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a large part of it. And but part of it is it's just an anemic form of common sense in American public discourse. You don't have to go to a nuclear weapons lab to find this kind of casual racism. You can open the opinion page of any American newspaper and find it there at least once a week these days. If you read an opinion piece about Iraq or Iran or about North Korea, it's just become something that's not even necessary to justify. Of course, everyone thinks that we're much more trustworthy with nuclear weapons than people of other skin colours and religious beliefs.
Well, they lost the Soviet Union to project their dark side on, and vice versa. So now you have to replace that with another enemy, otherwise you can't maintain your sanity. I'm being facetious
again.
Well,
there is also an interesting process here, actually, where when a country crosses the nuclear threshold,
yeah,
there's this sort of panic about how they're going to behave with nuclear weapons. And then gradually, over the years, over the decades, they become sort of normalized and accepted. So if you look in the 1940s, the American reaction to Stalin testing a nuclear weapon was absolutely hysterical. That, you know, now it was all over. Of course, the Russians wouldn't behave with restraint. By the 1970s, the Russians were being treated as sort of a reliable partner in a sort of ritualized enmity. The Chinese were talked about this way, and then gradually they became treated as being responsible. I think we're seeing the Indians right now being normalized in this way. At first, when they tested their weapons in 1998, there were all sorts of starkly racist comments about Indians with nuclear weapons on the opinion pages of U.S. newspapers. And now the same commentators are busy pushing for the India-U.S. Nuclear deal so that the U.S. would be allowed to sell them uranium and make a huge profit.
Oh, dear, there's a lot of pathology, isn't there, Hugh? And
yes, there is.
I just don't know if there's much hope. I'm fascinated by how the Department of Energy recruit and employ anthropologists to work out what to do with their radioactive waste that they've produced over the years, huge amounts, and what signs to put on the waste to warn future generations not to go near it, or they'll develop cancers or, you know, die acutely of acute radiation illness. Can you talk about that?
Well, I know that many years ago the Department of Energy did sponsor a competition for signs. You know, the problem is that nuclear waste has a half-life of thousands and thousands and thousands of years. If you go back 50,000 years, we don't have a very good ability to understand what remains of languages that were being used then.
Mm.
So the question is, what could you put on a sign? Would a skull and crossbones intuitively warn any human being who saw it that there was something dangerous there and that you shouldn't dig? You know, some anthropologists went for the money to try and think what the signs might be, but I think the consensus is that it's an impossible task.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just impossible to predict how human beings we can't visualize 50,000 or 100,000 years from now might interpret a particular sign.
Yes.
To us, a skull and crossbones, we've been conditioned to see it as a sign of danger. But there's no reason objectively why someone who's never seen that sign before has to interpret it that way. So I think they're kind of stuck on that one, and it's one of the problems with nuclear waste.
Yeah, and it's interesting that how politicians in general, and the sort of generic way of thinking is, as they accept a nuclear country, they say, well, their politicians are stable, and it's okay if we sell them uranium, i.e. India. But the thing is that when you fission uranium in reactors, you make plutonium, which lasts for 500,000 years, which is the fuel for nuclear weapons, and there's no discussion about the stability or instability of those societies as they proceed into the future. And, you know, mad politicians can arise, dictatorships can arise, like Musharraf took over Pakistan in a coup, and Pakistan has about 50 nuclear weapons. So that issue is really never addressed, and I'm fascinated by that too.
Well, I think if you talk to nuclear weapons scientists, there is this sort of stunted imagination that they have about the political context in which their weapons are inserted.
Mm.
There's this sort of assumption that the political reality we live in now is inevitably going to self-perpetuate, that it can't really change. And I actually blame political scientists for this in part.
Mm.
The political scientists that I've known, in international security especially, don't tend to have a very strong historical sense of how the international system keeps changing. And so they encourage these weapons professionals to think about the current international reality as if it's somehow frozen indefinitely. And I think, you know, my first degree is in history. International systems change over time.
All the time.
You know, for some of your older listeners, they remember a time when the United Nations didn't exist. The United Nations may not have worked out as well as its founders hoped, but it's created a very different kind of global system.
Yeah.
There never used to be a court of international human rights crimes, which there is now at The Hague and so on.
Yeah, and that could change too.
Yeah.
Within the next 100 years.
You did say one thing about how depressing this all is.
Yeah.
And I realize that the conversation we're having might be disheartening for some of your listeners, so I think it might be important for your listeners to know that the news isn't all bleak, I think. I mean, first of all, we seem to be making good progress rolling back North Korea's nuclear weapons program. There have been countries that have acquired nuclear weapons that have then given them up.
Mm-hmm.
South Africa had a small number of nuclear weapons under the white minority government. They decided to abolish them when they handed over the keys to the country to Nelson Mandela. They didn't just dismantle the weapons, they destroyed all the plans for how to make them, all the facilities that were used in designing and making them. They had a sort of scorched earth policy to roll the clock back completely to before they had nuclear weapons. When the Soviet Union split apart, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Belarus acquired nuclear weapons overnight, and they were persuaded to give them up. So there have been countries that have had nuclear weapons and decided to renounce them. North Korea may be about to join that list. There have been countries that were pretty far down the road towards a nuclear weapon and were induced to turn back. Taiwan in the 1970s, Brazil and Argentina in an earlier period. So although it's part of the common sense of weapon scientists that you can't put the genie back in the bottle, I don't think that's true. And one of the things that I find particularly interesting about the moment we're living in right now is that there is a new abolitionist movement. By this, I mean a movement to abolish nuclear weapons.
Yep.
Now, there has long been a movement on the left of American life to completely abolish nuclear weapons, and it's been dismissed by people from the rest of the political spectrum as naive and idealistic. But something very interesting that's happened is that in the last 2 years, a very powerful, influential group of right-wing abolitionists has appeared. I'm talking here about Henry Kissinger, former Reagan Secretary of State George Shultz, Sam Nunn, the former chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and a conservative Democrat. They've written two opinion pieces in the Wall Street Journal calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Earlier this month, three former British Secretaries of Defense wrote a piece for the Times of London calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. And two of those Secretaries of Defense served in conservative governments. So something very interesting is happening, that the kind of people that you do not expect to be naive and utopian and idealistic, these hard-bitten conservative realists, are making a case for abolishing nuclear weapons. And I think the reason they're doing this is that they are terrified by the prospect of nuclear weapons spreading not only to more and more countries, but to subnational groups, to terrorist groups, who cannot be deterred because they have no territory against which retaliation can be threatened. And so faced with the prospect of a nuclear-armed al-Qaeda, they've decided that it's time to abolish the weapons completely before they leak into the wrong hands. So I never thought I would say that I found anything Henry Kissinger said a source of hope, but I do in this case.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful, Hugh. It's sort of coming full circle, I guess, after we started the whole thing way back, or some of us. Now, you mentioned the subject of whether anthropologists should participate in counterinsurgency. I really didn't know they were doing that. How and why?
The new Secretary of Defense in the U.S., Robert Gates, has decided that the key to victory in counterinsurgency campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan is cultural knowledge. And he's come to the realization, and I think it's an accurate realization, that American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan have generated opposition to themselves. They've made their lives more difficult through their own cultural insensitivity, their own cloddishness. They don't know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite. They don't know how you treat local women. They often don't know that you don't show the soles of your feet to people. It's an insult and that kind of thing. And so the Department of Defense has decided in the last couple of years that they really have to get a lot more cultural knowledge. They have to train troops to behave in culturally appropriate ways, and they have to try and figure out what's going on in the minds of the local population so they know which ones to kill, which ones might be on their side, and so they know, in general, how to do a smoother running kind of occupation. And the people who understand culture, of course, are anthropologists. So there's been a big push in the last 2 years to recruit lots of anthropologists by the Pentagon. And the project that particularly has concerned me is something called Human Terrain Teams. So the idea is that every brigade in Iraq and Afghanistan would have attached to it a human terrain team of five people, two of whom would be social scientists, preferably anthropologists. And it would be their job to go out into local communities and figure out what was going on in villages, talk to village leaders and so on, and collect intelligence about what's going on the local terrain and feed that back to military commanders.
Mm.
So the U.S. doesn't have this program completely up and running at the moment. They're still trying to recruit more anthropologists and other social scientists. If, like me, you're an anthropologist, this is a very, very troubling development. And I hope that my colleagues in anthropology would be troubled by this, even if they support the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, because the sort of prime directive in anthropology is that you do no harm to your human subjects, to the people you study. I mean, in my own case, I could have used what I learned about weapon scientists to try and do them in, to try and do great harm to the nuclear weapons labs as institutions.
Mm.
And although my politics are such that I don't really support the nuclear weapons lab's mission, I would never do that because I think it would be a breach of anthropological ethics to study people and then use the knowledge you've learned from people and about people against them to subjugate them, to destroy their societies, to help them be dismantled or occupied or whatever. So for this reason, most American anthropologists are very troubled by the human terrain team system, and the American Anthropological Association has issued a formal statement condemning human terrain teams and strongly discouraging anthropologists from participating in them. I, along with 10 other anthropologists, established a group called the Network of Concerned Anthropologists, and if any of your listeners want to Google Concerned Anthropologists, our website will be the first thing that will come up. And the Network of Concerned Anthropologists has now gathered signatures from about 1,000 anthropologists pledging not to be engaged in counterinsurgency work in any way. And the concern is not only that we shouldn't betray our human subjects, the concern also is that if a small minority of anthropologists are busy working for intelligence agencies or for the Pentagon trying to subjugate other people, all anthropologists everywhere will be suspected of doing this.
Mm.
And you can talk to any anthropologist who's worked abroad anywhere, and they will always tell you that there comes a point in their field research where someone says, come on, you know, tell us, you're working for the CIA,
yeah,
aren't you? That's why you're doing this study.
Yeah.
And, you know, we often have to work quite hard to get people to trust us. And now if it's publicized that there are anthropologists out there getting weapons training,
yeah,
feeding intelligence to the U.S. military, it's really going to make everyone's life a lot harder.
How many anthropologists are there in the United States, Hugh?
There's about 10,000.
Oh, really?
At the annual meeting, you get between 4,000 and 5,000 show up. But the Anthropology Association has somewhere around 10,000 members. So getting 1,000 to sign this pledge is really quite something.
And have papers on this subject been presented at the annual meeting of anthropologists?
Oh, yes. At last year's annual meeting, it was the contentious hot topic.
Oh, good.
And actually, as I speak, the Anthropology Association is embroiled in a struggle right now over the rewriting of its ethics code.
Oh.
Shortly after the Vietnam War, in the midst of the Vietnam War in 1971, the association adopted a very strongly worded ethics code that forbade clandestine research of any kind and said that any knowledge that was gathered about people should be shared with the people about whom it was gathered.
Mm.
It couldn't be given to sponsors of research and not to the people the reports were written about.
Mm.
Now, in the mid-1980s, that language was watered down. Now, last year's anthropology meeting, there was a motion to restore the much stronger language from 1971. And so the association is now embroiled in a struggle about whether to go back to that older language that would declare it unethical to generate knowledge about people, but then share it with, say, the Pentagon, or with intelligence agencies, but not with the people themselves.
Yes, it seems to me that anthropologists, looking at it broadly, have a responsibility and an opportunity, in a certain sense, to lead society in directions that it hasn't even thought about before. And that's what so fascinates me about anthropologists, even more than psychologists or political scientists and the like. Would you agree with that, Hugh?
Well, I think the study of anthropology is a sort of exercise in imagination. It's a mind-bending discipline. You know, you grow up in a particular society where you take it for granted that one man has one wife or whatever, and then suddenly you find out there are all these permutations. There are societies where one woman has four husbands or one man has 200 wives. You can repeat this sort of shock of the encounter with cultural difference for religion, for folklore, for origin myths, and so on. So anthropology really is a sort of opening of the imagination to all sorts of different possibilities that might be undreamed of if you live within a very parochial little life. And so, yes, I think anthropology is about unleashing the human imagination. But I think also, to go back to where we began, you know, if you remember, I talked about moving to Livermore and how an anthropologist goes about understanding people. Mm. An anthropologist understands people by hanging out with them, by moving in with them. Well, it's a unique research methodology, and with it come unique ethical obligations.
Yes.
If you study people through archival sources,
yes,
you don't have the same kind of moral obligation to them that you do if you hang out with them in a coffee shop every day, or if you live with them in their home, if they learn to trust you, if they tell you their most intimate thoughts that they might not tell their next-door neighbor. And if you write these notes, these thoughts down in notes where you disguise their identity so that if the notes fall into the wrong hands, what they say couldn't be used against them. You know, so anthropologists have this really unique ethical obligation towards the people who make it possible for us to know things. And so that's why, of all the kinds of academics there are out there, we are the last who should be out there helping the Pentagon to subjugate the people we work with, because, you know, they trusted us. That's how we know about them.
Yeah.
We shouldn't betray their trust.
Yes, it kind of reminds me of the obligations and the Hippocratic Oath that we take as physicians, and how sacred our relationship is with any patient who comes in and tells us their deepest secrets and fears, and, you know, we examine them naked on the couch, and it's an incredible responsibility and trust, and it's kind of a similar thing, isn't it, metaphorically, that you do. Yeah,
it's a perfect analogy, I think.
Hugh, I really want to thank you. That was Hugh Gustafson for a fascinating interview, which leads into so many avenues of thinking that we'll all be stimulated to do after this interview. And maybe in a year or so, we can have you back to discuss more thoughts that you have and where we can go from there.
Well, that would be delightful. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much, Hugh. That was Professor Hugh Gustafson, an anthropologist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and author of three books, including Why America's Top Pundits Are Wrong, about to be published by UC Press. Thanks for joining us at If You Love This Planet. If you'd like to donate to the show, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. A special thanks to our host Pacifica station, KPFT, in Houston.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.